Welcome to Juice Podcast. Today I'm joined by my dear friend and colleague Arlene Stein. Arlene.
Thank you for having me, Emily.
Thanks for being part of the podcast. And at the moment, none of you have heard from us at Juice for some time. So the next few episodes are just going to be with me. And in the spring, Gwen and I will be back together with a new series. So yeah, in the meantime, you have me and Arlene today. Arlene, do you want to give a little introduction to who you are, what you do?
Sure. So I've been working in the world of food and wine for about 20 years, maybe a bit longer, but that would age me. And I have a keen interest in wine, as Emily knows, because we like to enjoy wine together. I'm not as knowledgeable about most, but I've worked in the circle of it, and I'm really keen on knowing more about natural wine and the state of wine and innovations in wine. So I'm excited to be here, and I'm excited to learn about Beaujolais.
Yeah, so today we have five wines from the region of Beaujolais, actually, which is super exciting. I think I might open the first one so we at least have, as you know, on the podcast here, we always make sure that our glass is never left empty.
I didn't know that was a rule or a creed, but I'm glad it is. Maybe I can start asking you some questions, because I'm actually super curious about this. So my knowledge of Beaujolais is, of course, from the Beaujolais Nouveau, which is quite prevalent, has been in my course of history and working in this industry. Didn't always have a great reputation, but was a nice fresh wine that sort of introduced a lot of people, especially in North America, to the grape, to the region, and then also to Gamay. I'd love to let me know a little bit more about the region and what's significant about it. I know it sits between Burgundy and Rhone, two of my favorite regions.
Yes.
And so what's special about this?
Like, the region has more in common with the Rhone, but from a wine style perspective, more in common with Burgundy, actually, I think. So it's quite an interesting kind of meeting point between those two regions. And I would say, I'm very much of the opinion that it was like kind of the last fine wine region to be discovered in France, I think, because, you know, it didn't always have the best reputation for fine wine, let's say, because the reputation for Beaujolais Nouveau was so prominent that I think everybody associated the region with just that style of wine, which was that young, fruity, fresh, like, just drink it and really don't think about it too much. Yeah, and also it's at a certain price point, which...
easy.
Yeah. Definitely in the wine trade and the wine business, we know it to be a region that produces very fine wine. And actually, in general, aside from maybe some certain producers that you find in any region, I would say the quality is very high overall. So for me, it's one of the most exciting regions. It's a region that also is accessible to young winemakers, because the vineyards aren't crazy prices and there are small patches of vineyards available for renting. So we see quite a lot of young negotiant producers renting patches of vines, slowly sort of expanding on their range. And actually we have like a couple of I would say like newer upcoming producers and sort of more established newer producers too today as well.
So that's something from a business level that I think is super fascinating that people don't know a lot about. I mean, France is very well established, as people know, in the wine world. It's an old world region, has some of the most expensive wines in the world that are coming from it. As a young person, again, how can you find something? Like, are you attached to a family that owns land, or... Can I go and buy a piece of land in Beaujolais and find something that's affordable, that I'm going to be productive within a few years?
I think maybe buying is harder, but definitely renting is possible. And I think, obviously, you don't just sort of rock up and look in the real estate magazine. I think it's good to have connections and know people.
You don't?
No, but I think Beaujolais is one of the areas where we see more movement, and it's quite dynamic in that way. It makes it really exciting for me, actually, because there's sort of new producers to discover all the time.
Well, and that's the one thing they say about France, too, is that because they are so, like, there's deep-seated traditions and foundations of, like, the way things should be done. So I would imagine, you know, having a place that is open to new, young, innovative winemakers would be a bit of a breath of fresh air or fresh wine.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one part. And then I think, just going back to your first question about what makes the region really exciting, is I think just love the grape variety and the soils. It's a region that's very diverse in the soils, and it's very old soils as well. So depending on where the wine comes from within the appellation, the style of wine will be different and have a different set of characteristics based on that as well. So it's quite an interesting region in that way.
So varietal, Gamay is the predominant varietal.
100% Gamay, G-A-M-A-Y. We've only got Gamay. There's only two appellations. There's only two grapes in the appellation, and that's Chardonnay for the whites, which really represents a small amount of production. And then, Gamay for all of the reds.
Cool.
And we've got, 12 different appellations in total.
Nice.
Yeah. Beaujolais Village, and then the 10 cru. So we'll talk about the cru because we're going to taste. We've got three cru today to try across the five wines. And dig into those a bit more.
Should we taste a little bit before I ask more questions?
Yeah, let's do it. So okay. I actually pulled two wines because I wasn't sure which one we should start with, so I thought we could decide. But I think the second one I pulled, which is this guy, is the one we should start with. So I've just poured for us the Marc Delien Greta Carlo 2016 Fleury.
A little bit more rusty than this one. This one's got its deep purple.
Exactly. It's a lot lighter, isn't it, in colour and a little bit... I mean, you can see it's obviously unfiltered, so you can see that, but it's quite transparent at the same time.
Yeah.
So Fleury, particularly in the UK, is a really well-known sort of appellation and a really well-known cru with, I guess the reason why I like it, and I think the reason why many people know Fleury, and often I would say in the UK, more people know Fleury than they do know that it's from Beaujolais sometimes. Like it's really made its own brand, as I love that it has this lovely, light, elegant, really just like fine tannins, low tannins, and this pretty fruit and aromas, and always in Fleury for me.
Can you tell us a bit about the winemaker?
Yeah, so relatively, I think he's only been making wine for around 5 or 6 years. This wasn't his first calling, and he's in his mid-50s now.
So there's hope for all of us.
There's hope for all of us. And he had studied, I think, at Domaine de Trévaillon in Provence, and then started making natural wines in Beaujolais. And he, I actually read a quote, and it said something like, "Well, what else would you do if you're going to change your career in your 50s? And I was like, it's kind of got a point. This is 100% carbonic maceration. So the grapes are put into a tank and sealed off with carbon dioxide inside. So we get sort of a really different profile. It's got that sort of typical, this almost like bubblegum cherry fruit. It's starting to go down now, I think, because of the age, but it's a lot more lifted on the nose in terms of the aromatics. Using concrete, biodynamic farming. The vines are 40 to 80 years of age. Everything's hand-picked.
So would it have been a family farm then? Originally, do you know?
No, I think he acquired the plots himself. And I don't actually know where this particular plot is for this wine. I know it's in the appellation of Fleury, but there's no Ludi or vineyard written on the back.
And the concrete storage, which I know is...
Yeah.
Splattered throughout Europe, but you see it more in sort of Spain and France, at least in my experience. I feel like I tasted in this wine.
Yeah.
Not steely, but almost like a lot of mineral.
Yeah, I think that's also the soils, but I think the use of concrete is great as a tool for winemaking because it's not as airtight as stainless steel, so it's not as reductive in the winemaking process. And then also... it doesn't flavour the wine like wood does. So you have this lovely purity of fruit shining through and you can see, I think you see the terroir more and you can see the soil more in those wines.
It's quite lovely. It's easy and it's fresh. Well, fresh.
Yeah, pretty and elegant. And I think that comes mainly because of the soils in Fleury. So there's a high proportion of, it's almost entirely, it's like 90% pink granite and it's like a sandy pink granite. So it sort of, that's the reason why you get more sort of, you get lower tannins and more of this very pretty, elegant, almost, I don't want to say feminine because I'm trying not to use gender anymore to describe wines. But yeah, this sort of pretty, delicate aroma. But I think what's interesting about Fleury is that it's the highest part of Beaujolais.
There you go. That's sort of what I was getting at. Yeah. So altitude-wise. Do you get a lot of range of altitude in Burgundy? Not in Burgundy, I'm sorry. Do you get a lot of range of altitude in Beaujolais?
A lot of range of altitude.
Because it's a valley.
Yeah, yes, but I mean, it's not drastic like Etna or anything like that, but yes, there's like several hundred meters between the different crews. So Fleury, the top vineyard, La Madone, is at 425 meters. And there are other crews that sit at like 250, for example. Okay. And it's a very, it's quite interesting Fleury, because when you're there and you do go up to the La Madone, you're kind of on this hill, like the hill, and you can look over and you can see the other Appalachians in the distance as well. So it's a very pretty place to visit too.
So beautiful.
Yeah. And it's not a, it's not one of the smallest Appalachians, but it's not one of the biggest ones either. It's 830 hectares in total and 150 growers in Fleury alone.
Nice. And are they all producing independently, or is there a consortium as well?
In terms of, I don't know, in terms of, I mean, it's, I know it's 150 vine growers, but I would have to check the number of producers actually. But in general, I would say, I'd have to get the figures from the Appalachian, but there are a lot of vignerons that are working in their vines and producing the wine from their vineyards. It's quite an interesting region in that way. Like, it's really, people are working the land and making wine from that land.
That's really nice, because in some regions, especially the lesser known regions like Languedoc, that's not necessarily the case.
No, I mean, in the Languedoc, it's kind of, and like even in the Roussillon, I mean, people are abandoning vineyards because it's so tough. But in Bordeaux, for example, also, it's a mixed bag where you have sort of, you know, machine harvesting, for example. That's something that really doesn't really happen in Beaujolais because of the way in which the vines themselves are grown.
I was going to ask next, and maybe this is too complicated, but is there any impacts of climate change coming in the region that people are fearful of?
No, I mean, I ask that question. Everybody, I mean, every grower that I've ever spoken to in any region says yes, and they notice that. And I think there has been some things changing. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing for Beaujolais in terms of hydric, like, I don't know why I was about to say that in a French accent, but in terms of like water stress, I think it is something in certain parts of certain Appalachians where they are noticing the lack of water is an issue, but that's more of an issue, I think, than the heat and sunburn.
Sure.
And I mean, in my opinion as well, sometimes it can help in certain Appalachians to just have a little bit more fruitiness and a little bit more softness, particularly in Appalachians like Morgon. I mean, it has quite a mild climate. I mean, we'll talk about it when we get there, but quite a mild climate, but then quite mineral, like hard soils. Mm-hmm. So you can get quite structured wines out of that Appalachian. So sometimes having that ripeness is a nice thing for maybe a more harmonious wine, but it really depends vintage to vintage as well.
Cool.
Yeah. So that's, yes, we've tried Marc Delien, and then in the second glass, we've actually got a producer that I visited last August, which I didn't, I mean, it's shocking. I still can't believe we made it to Beaujolais, like, in the midst of the pandemic, but it happened.
In a very, it's almost like it was not a pandemic for, like, 2 months this summer. It's like, I know. A reprieve. I wish we had a reprieve.
I mean, I do remember wearing my mask for about 8 hours a day and just thinking, oh, gosh, this is so hot. But, and it was 37 degrees every day.
Yeah.
It's like, it was... Cool. Well, it's
literally not cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So we've got, anyway, so I visited this gentleman here called Grégoire Hopineau. Mm. And actually, I love the labels because these are maps of the vineyards, all the different Ludi as well.
Yeah.
So this is Domaine Grégoire Hopineau, Fleury, Clos de Lamandière.
Same Appalachian,
same region, slightly different winemaking.
I was going to say, what's the difference? This is non-filtered, this is natural.
Yeah, so actually, Grégoire Hopineau, I don't think he uses sulfur in his wines, and I think a little bit more sulfur, but for me, he's kind of like on the classic side of natural in terms of the winemaking. Like, there is sulfur, but I don't believe anything else is being added to the wines, from my knowledge. So there's a lovely finesse and purity to the wines too. And this is from, so the Clos de Lamandière is a part of the Poncier, but like at the foothills of that. And it's quite interesting because the viticulture is different. So one parcel is with the bush vines and one part is with the Cordon Royal as well.
So tell me a little bit about these bush vines, because I saw them for the first time a couple of years ago when we were traveling through the south of France.
Yep.
This isn't the south of France, obviously, but it was the first time I'd ever seen that sort of method of trailing. And so what's the point of that? I'd like to learn a little bit more. Yeah. And why only in certain regions are they using that kind of...
So it really depends on the region. I know, like, for example, in places like Sierra de Gredos in Spain and Mount Etna, with the soil types and older vines, and hotter sunshine days, like in South Africa, for example, when they grow Chenin Blanc, it's always bush vine because you have the protection of the leaves sort of draping over the grapes, so you're protected from the grapes over-ripening.
So, but explain just a little bit first, because I think some people aren't familiar with it, like the way they bring them up, and
so
they're not trailing.
No, so traditionally, I think many people know that a vineyard usually kind of looks like mm-hmm. a vine, like a little bit like a scarecrow with the arms stretched out and exactly. the grapes hanging underneath them. It's quite different, isn't
it? I got chocolate.
Yeah, it's really delicious, this wine.
Sorry.
And then, but with the bush vines, it's you're not doing anything to it. It's just the way that the plant naturally grows, and it looks like a bush. So you have a sort of short, depends on the grape variety, depends on the soil, depends on the climate of like how high that bush vine is. But I mean, in Beaujolais, they're very small actually. And they're kind of, for me, they always remind me of like little witch's claws coming out of the ground when you see them without the leaves on. And I don't know why that is, but it's always stuck with me that it's got this kind of like Tim Burton vibe. But they look like...
Well, when I saw them, I actually didn't think they were vines. I thought it must be some kind of mysterious fruit tree. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the best time to see them is when there are no leaves on them. But yeah, now there's been a bit of a movement. I think it might be to do with more rain and things like that, that they're moving more towards cordon rayat, the traditional method of training. And also for a lot of producers, when they're in the vineyards working by hand, it's really, really, like there's a high amount of labor that they have to work in the vineyards. Like, sure. There's many hours of like, you can't take a machine for anything. You can't even take a tractor down the line to help pick up the boxes for the grapes, for example. Like,
it's too small.
Like
are they terraced?
No terracing, that's not really a thing in Beaujolais. Okay. You do have some steep slopes. Of course, steep slopes you can never use machinery for, but I think it's just a case of it's easier to make the work by hand. It just takes a little bit of pressure off people. That's what quite a few of the growers were saying, is that for them to look after these old vines and protect them and keep them kind of disease-free, they were moving more towards cordon rayat. So that's crazy. Changing.
So everything's handpicked that we're tasting today.
Yeah, everything is in all of the wines that we're trying, yeah.
That's amazing. It's very expensive too, right? It's very labor intensive.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be honest, yeah. I find this heavy, but I probably find
it heavier.
Yeah. This is the thing. So in comparison to this, I love this one. I think
so for those that are on audio, that's the Greta Garbo from Marc Dillon is your preference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm. I just, what did you call it? Not frilly, but I might call it frilly.
Pretty and lacy. Pretty. And
lacy.
Fresh.
Lacy, yeah, is like where I was getting that. Exactly. So for me, I just think that this is easy and cheerful. I think that's what I said before.
I mean,
and then I like this one. It's much more complex. Has a lot more depth.
The hoppy note, yeah, I think so too. And I think it's interesting because there are similarities. They're not like super tannic wines, but the fruit profile is different. But they're also from different vintages, right? Like 116. So I think in that Greta Garbo, you still have that lovely kind of lifted aroma and perfume. But this kind of like earthiness, like beetroot and things. And then with the Opino, like I think for me, what I love about it is like there is a bit more texture and there is a little bit more density. And I would also assume, but I'm not sure, I think, I just double checked my notes there. It's 8 months in old foudre. So you see a little bit of that impact of wood, even though it's large wood and it's old oak. I think you can still sort of see that in the texture of the wine, and it just makes it feel maybe a little bit more sophisticated in a certain way, but not necessarily being better, but just like a different expression. And I think that's what's really interesting, is there's like the fingerprint of Fleury, but there's also like this lovely, you can see like the different vignoles within the appellation, and the different winemaking expresses itself in a certain way as well.
Well, that's what's really interesting about tasting the two wines, because I do think that they're very different. I mean, same grape, same appellation, and yet two distinct characteristics in each of them.
Yeah, and I think I know as well, just I was just looking at my notes there as well, with the Delhi and the Greta Carbo, like a lot of that's more sandier soils, and where Greg Wild's wines, or vines, sorry, are, it's a little bit stonier as well. So I think that's what's also adding to like this sort of richer or slightly more dense palate as well. But yeah, I love Fleury.
I love both of them actually.
Yeah.
I just drink lots of that one.
Yeah, because it's so light.
It's
right?
So light, exactly.
And like,
what's the alcohol?
Like 12%.
Ah, there you go. And what,
very light.
Do you know what this was?
It was 13.
Yeah. Mm. So you can see that. And yeah, I could drink this by itself. I could drink it with a cheese board and some charcuterie. I might probably want this with a meal. Something a little heavier, I think.
Yeah, I think as well, like with, I mean, that's got kind of the typical thing as well of like casse-croûte, when you have rillette and charcuterie or some cheese and some bread, like, and then, you know, some cornichon, and you're eating these things, and like a wine like this, just like
perfect.
It's like a dream, isn't it, being in Beaujolais, eating those things, drinking those things, just like yeah. So I think from here we should go on to the,
should we get rid of these
if you would like to? Yes,
yeah, I will.
I'm gonna keep one and I'm gonna keep that one there. You might want to compare it, like...
Ah, fair enough.
Keep one to compare,
right,
maybe.
So we'll just use one glass.
So...
Now that's really dark as well.
So this... this is... I mean, it's difficult because we're in the...
Dark?
The evening light at Aura. So this is the... 2000, I just didn't check the vintage yet. 2018 again, but it's Côte de Brie from Alex Foyard.
So this actually smells to me, you talked about those notes of bubblegum and like light cherry. That to me smells like a typical Beaujolais.
Yeah, it's got this really lifted, I love this. It's got this really lifted aromatic profile where it's got this kind of like raspberry candy, almost violet tones coming out. It's like quite floral actually.
That would be something I would be most familiar with. The other two wines, like I said, with this one, the chocolate and the plum hit me.
I think with the Marc Delien that we tried at the beginning, it's, well, it's carbonic maceration, but it's with, it's 2016, so it started to develop, so it does taste a little bit different to what you would expect. I think also there's kind of a misunderstanding around when to drink Beaujolais wines, because I think because of Beaujolais Nouveau, there is a presumption that all wines from this region should be consumed whilst young.
Sure.
And I would say this is what is amazing about this region, because actually a lot of these wines age very well. Like the first time I went to Beaujolais, it was like 2013, and I went there and somebody served me a 99 Fleury, so it was already over 10 years old. And I was like, wow, this wine's amazing. Why have I never been told, like, these wines age really well? And of course they do, because they're fine wines. And just because of a wine isn't super tannic doesn't mean that it's not great. You know, like, I think that everything's shifting now in wine. And if a wine's made well from good terroir, there's potential for aging. And
well, I want to talk to you a little bit about that, because I didn't get to ask the question. But first, I want to say I love this. I think it's delicious. I really, really love this. It's my favorite. So far. But this idea that a wine region gets known for a particular thing, in this case, young, new wines, the Gamay that's new, because it was a marketing, part of a marketing scheme to bring representation to the region and differentiate itself. Champagne has done that. There are many other locales, Napa.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, Beaujolais as well, it's been like, it's like a radical self-reclamation of this region for all of the growers there, because there was a time, you know, like all of the original natural wine guys, like when you look at the movement of when that started, which is an old story now, but like when you look at that, that was at a time it was really challenging to be able to sell the wines and also like grow the grapes and be able to cover your costs. Like it was a really challenging time. And I think this is really to the testament of the terroir and the people in the region, to like how quickly they've actually created a region that really is a gastronomic wine producing region.
Because, and a new identity, essentially.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is what for me is really exciting about Beaujolais, is it's that lovely... It's that lovely mix of like classic conventional, but then also like kind of radical and new and exciting and dynamic and sort of cutting edge as well. Like, it's in some ways like kind of the most classic region, but also the most hipster. Like, it manages those two like the dichotomy of those two faces of Beaujolais. It manages that really well and delivers, depending on who's drinking it. Like, it's really, the audience, I think, is wider than in other regions.
And you've covered some of this already, but what would you say are the strengths moving forward in terms of bringing it to the forefront of that gastronomic wine growing region at this point?
The strengths?
Yeah.
When you say the strengths of the region bringing it forward, you mean like what? Why is it becoming?
Yeah, what is it about the region that collectively they're going to make an identity for themselves? I mean, every wine region kind of has to struggle to work together because as a general consumer, you know, we're not going to know each of these individual wines, but we're going to go on the reputation of the space. We know that a lot of Central European wine regions struggle because, well, we know why, because of collectivization of agriculture and all these other sort of historical downsides that they have, and they're trying to make a name for themselves.
Yes.
But France, you've got this, I mean, one of their struggles, I would presume, is that, again, in this wine region that is so well known for making some of the best and most expensive wines in the world, as a small producer from Beaujolais, like, how do you work as a collective, as a series of appellations to actually make your mark and say, we are the place that has the innovation, that has the forward thinkingness, that has a dynamic blend of like really new and innovative and also traditional? Like, what is it, where do you see them going, and what are the strengths that are going to pull them that way?
I mean, I really think it's like, it's quite simple, I think. And I think that is the terroir, like, it's the soils there with the grape variety will produce high quality wines. That's like, of course, fundamental for any region that's going to be recognized globally, and will continue to be, like, the longevity of that will be maintained because of that. It has to come down to the soil, it has to come down to the terroir, and it's amazing, an amazing region for that. Like, that is fundamentally the first thing, and the second thing on that is the people in the region, the people that are working the land, the people that are making these wines. Like, of course, you can have amazing terroir and you can have vineyards there, but if people aren't farming them the right way and they're not producing the wines in the right way, that's it. And it's like, it's really like, this is the thing, it's not a contrived thing, actually.
Yeah.
It's like the opposite. It's like really pure, and it's just like, hey, we've got something, we've got an amazing opportunity here with this soil, with these grapes, to make something spectacular. And it's, someone has to just take that role and do that. Like,
well, I was going to say, and as you mentioned at the beginning, which I think is so lovely, is because it is more accessible, you bring in the young blood. Even your 50-year-old winemaker, still young blood. Right? But really, you're bringing in new people that aren't necessarily tied to the tradition necessarily.
Yeah, and I think that is the thing. There are people like, I mean, there's like Andrew and Emma Nielsen from Le Grappin, who are negotiants, and they're working in the south of the southern part of Burgundy, and also in Beaujolais, and they're making amazing wines, and they've had terrific success in the UK market with the wines. And I mean, they're Australian, you know, and they're coming in and they're making wines that are authentic and true to the place. But of course, like, when people come in with different expertise from different places and different knowledge bases, like, we talked about this when we were on the wine trip to Cyprus together, it's like, there needs to be, to some degree, some influx. If you don't have, you know, like, some influx is always healthy. If just, and I know this from being a restaurant owner.
Of course.
When we have new staff come, they all have a different experience that they're going to bring into this, which is then going to shape the business in a better way. And it just, yeah, progressive.
And they push everybody means, in the environment.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love this.
Yeah. So we're on Côte de Brie. I actually love this appellate, like, this crew.
So talk to me about the appellation, because this is different than...
Yes, so we're now in Côte de Brie, which is on the slopes of the Mont Brie. And visually, I think it's one of the most beautiful parts of Beaujolais, because you have this, basically, like, I mean, it's an old mountain, like old mountain, the Mont Brie. It's a UNESCO geopark, Mont Brie itself, and on the slopes of that, just going around it, you have this appellation. So it's for me, exciting, mainly because of the soil types. You have a lot of the bluestone, which is the oldest, geologically the oldest soil in Beaujolais is this old bluestone, where you get this amazing, very pretty, but at the same time structured wines. Like we'll get to one actually. The next one we're going to try is Morgon Côte Pie, and it's a part of the Morgon appellation, which is really dense in these bluestones. And I've got such a huge soft spot, I think, because I like wines that are maybe more austere. When I was in Beaujolais, I found that every time I was tasting particular wines, I was always really, like, I was just naturally drawn to the wines that were produced from vineyards that were grown on bluestone. And I think it's to do with the texture, the tannin, the interplay with the flavours that you get from that, this mineral, fresh acidity. Like, there's something, there is something really different. Like, when you compare this to the Fleury that we've tried, the texture of the wine is different. There's like a raciness in the mineral quality of the wine. And I do think there is like a different kind of density in this kind of like bittersweet saltiness almost that leads you back to it. And I say saltiness because this isn't a salty wine, but saltiness in that mineral kind of understanding of it. And I think this is just kind of the style of wines that I really appreciate. But this appellation is like 40% bluestone, and then there is granite, and there's a little bit as well of other stony soils, and it's just made up of 100 growers over 300 hectares. So everybody's small. Everybody's got, like, you know, I mean, the average is 3 hectares per grower. Small. Obviously there'll be some producers that have more, some that have less.
And would it be typical then in this region? So if you've only got 3 hectares, it's actually quite small for a wine producing person. Would you get grapes from other people, or would you singularly use the grapes off your plot?
I think it depends on the business model, and it depends on what volume of wine you want to make and what style of wine you're making. Of course, there are some people that buy and some people that grow and some people that do both.
Okay.
But yeah, so this, yeah, I just love this. So exciting.
Yeah. I love this too.
Yeah. I was just looking, because I made a little notes of like things that I was like, do I need to bring me up? But no, there isn't really, just that it's steeper slopes as well. So obviously everything's worked by hand. Again, of course, like most of the region, bluestone, which is like, yeah, produces like more intense wines, more expressive wines, you know. And I think, I'm pretty sure, but I need to, like, I'm like, you know, there's this kind of volcanic origin as well to this bluestone. You're on the old volcano that erupted one time. Like, it's quite interesting when you dig into the soils.
One time, years ago.
One time. Millennia ago.
I love it. 30,000 years ago when the volcano went off.
Yeah. So I kind of recommend that to people that want something that's more powerful, a little bit more spicy and a bit more structured.
What's the alcohol?
It's definitely more... the alcohol is 13.5.
Oh wow.
Yeah, but I think it's
doesn't
more powerful.
Feel like that.
Because of the blue stone, it's got this racy acidity and this freshness to the wine, which balances like the weight of it and also the structure of it.
The magic
more acid
blue stone.
The blue stone. It's a Lord of the Rings novel that was never written.
That's right.
Yes.
On the volcanic mountain.
Of the Mont Rui. So then we'll go now, we'll swap appellations. We're going to go to Morgon. So we've got two wines from Morgon next.
I can keep this then and get rid of my flurry.
Yeah, I guess you should, yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, just do it. Okay. So, yeah.
I'll just keep keeping my favourite wine and then seeing how we go.
Yeah, great. For people as well, I just realised we didn't talk anything about Alex Foyard. That was his third vintage. His first vintage was 2016 when he was 24 or 25. He's the son of Jean Foyard, and who is a very iconic, let's say, natural winemaker, part of the Gang of Four in Beaujolais.
The one we just did. Okay, okay.
And yeah.
So he's super young. That must be a family winery.
Yeah, I mean, he started helping his father with harvest when he was a teenager, and then he went off to study winemaking in Montpellier, came back to... Actually, he went to Burgundy next, and he worked at a winery called Pré-Roc for a few years, which is a very famous sort of natural wine estate in Neuilly-Saint-Georges, and then came back to Beaujolais in 15, and then started making his own wine in 16. Yeah, 24 he was when he was doing that, which is nice. Like... Yeah, it's pretty young, but also he would have had a lot of experience and kind of... you know, been quite precocious, because actually, like, he had all of that around him all of the time anyway. So that's his third vintage. It's still really good.
Are you pouring these two side by side?
Yeah, he needs to tip the other one away. Oh, you just drink it, yeah. That's good. You're making... This is exactly what Gwen does, so you're filling in well. She will be proud if she sees that.
I hope so. Yes. I hope so.
Yeah. So the wine on the left is the Domaine Rochette Morgon Cooked Pea 2018, and the wine on the right is the Célébrité Morgon from Sébastien Congretel.
Now, you did mention when we started this that they were both crus. Is that these two are crus, the Morgon?
Morgon is the cru, is the name of the cru. So there are 10 cru appellations in Beaujolais, and this is one of them, Morgon.
Okay.
So it's like the sub-zone, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. So Morgon is one of the, again, one of the larger appellations. So it's over 1,000 hectares. It's 1,100 hectares.
Okay.
And it's predominantly granite, but there are some bluestones as well, particularly around Morgon Cote de Pie is almost 100% bluestone, which is why it's become such a well-known ludi, or well-known area for producing wine, because of the unique soils there. So actually the Cote de Pie has a lot in common with the Cote de Brie that we just tried before, because of the soil makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also something that makes it kind of singular and a little bit different to the other wines in the appellation, because most of the rest of Morgon is on this granitic pink granite or granitic sand.
Okay.
So depending where you are in the appellation, the style of the wine will be different.
I'm getting some of those traditional flavors, like the sweetness and the candy. But I'm also getting like tobacco.
Yeah, there is. There's kind of a resinous quality to it, for sure. And in general, Morgon anyway, out of all of the cru, tends to be more full-bodied, richer, more robust. And I would say, you know, particularly for like wines from Cote de Pie as well, like very terroir-driven. Lovely acidity, lovely balance.
I love that word.
Terroir, or... Is that because your business is called terroir? Slightly biased.
I'm very biased.
Slightly nepotistic. But yeah, and also the appellation itself is an area that's quite sunny. So it has quite a mild climate and is... So the first one, actually, I don't know this producer so well, but it's a family-run winery that's been in the family for many generations, and it's now the son making the wine. They're around 15 hectares, so it's the biggest producer that we've tried today, because we've... Many of the wines that we've tried come from like 2 to 3 hectares. So it's still...
The one before still was very, 3. Yeah.
Yeah, and the second one that we're trying we'll get to, but it's smaller. But 15 is still obviously very small.
Mm-hmm.
But this is very common in Beaujolais to have wineries this size as well.
I like this.
Quite traditional winemaking. Everything's 100% bush vine, Gobelet as well here. So they haven't changed any of their farming, which is obviously, yeah, keeping with the tradition. They're located at about 300 metres... which is quite high for the appellation. So I think that's why there's like just a little bit more lift as well. But yeah.
So that's meaty wine. Not meaty, but like it's...
There's a savory. There's a savouriness. Yes. There's more tannin. Umami. Yeah, it's like it's more robust, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's a higher alcohol, it must be.
13.5.
Oh, same as
but
the last one.
But can be higher than that because you've got... Basically, it's like a small... hillside. I mean, it's not that small. I thought it was going to be smaller, but like, I mean, it's not huge at the same time, but imagine just like a hill coming up. You've got this like dense bluestone, old volcanic stone, and then sun just like beating down on that hill all day. And then there's like a solo tree on the top, which is, it's kind of magical. But anyway, this is from that vineyard site. So
that's so beautiful.
Yeah.
And what about, is there oak on that? Cause that tastes like it's got some oak.
There, I think there's old oak, but I don't think it's vinified in tank, so it's definitely vinified in stainless steel.
Okay.
And I think there's some old wood just for the élevage before bottling.
And question for you that may not be relevant at all, but just curious, I was curious about this. Do they use French oak?
Yes. Why would you ship something, especially like... For a region like this, where they're...
Well, but they do all the time. In Central Europe, they ship Americans. In America, they ship Hungarians. Like, not people, obviously barrels.
Yeah.
But
yes.
They were shipping people, they'd be super weird. Although they do, it's called immigration.
No. Slavery.
Yeah.
But I think No, I think, you know, when you're making wines like this is also one of the topics that comes up quite a lot with the natural wine question about using like foreign containers or vessels. Like, does that make, like, if you're, okay, you
could. Well, I guess that's why I ask, because I'm always curious. And yeah. I've seen winemakers who always do. They ship wine barrels all over the world. And sometimes it's just a matter of a relationship that they might have with a cooperage that is in a place where they had maybe a connection or a friend, or maybe they grew wines there at one point. But it's odd to me, because if you're talking about being natural and sustainable and ethical,
local has to be like so much a part of that.
And shouldn't the barrel have the terroir of the place as well?
Mm. Yeah, I think, but then, yeah, if you want to make like traditional wines, and traditional wines in the best sense, I think.
I think so too.
Yeah, I'm pondering on that a lot, actually. Is that the food question as well? Which links into veganism, which we could go into that, but that should be saved for another time, because we could go off on a tangent on that. But like, there are so many ethical choices in this which are complicated, multifaceted as well.
So you know what term I'm starting to use now as a catch-all or an umbrella? It's conscientious. Because I don't think we can be dogmatic about these ideologies, but I think we can make conscious choices.
Yeah, we can be aware of what that means.
And why we made a decision. So if we're making something that doesn't wholeheartedly like fall into that natural or sustainable or organic or because I don't think we can all the time, then we do it conscientiously.
Yep.
That's my thought.
I concur. So let's move on to the next ones. We just tried that. So we've got Sebastian Congretel, 2017, the Morgon here. So actually, another new winemaker started in 2015, 2.5 hectares. And I bought this here actually in Berlin from the previous importer. 100% whole bunch, 12 days in concrete. The vineyards, or the vineyard itself, was planted in the mid-50s. And south-facing and predominantly sandy granite. So it's kind of...
Is that unfiltered?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And quite different. And I actually, in hindsight, maybe should have done them the other way around, because it is lighter. But maybe I was worried. I did think that maybe just knowing the wines that this had more flavour and more intensity.
I'm happy you did it this way.
Okay.
Because for me...
Okay, that doesn't look like a good face. Do I need to give you more Cote d'Ivoire?
This is the most challenging to drink, I would say, for me.
Okay.
It has that, and maybe because it's unfiltered. I mean, it's very similar in quality to this. For me, it has kind of a dusty note. Mm. And it's not a bad thing. It's just, it's got that sort of older age quality that...
So I don't find a dusty note in this wine, but...
Like I should smoke a pipe with this. Yeah, that'd be good. Or a cigar.
But I think, for me, I can see that resinous, like that resin kind of note, again, a little bit like this kind of like freshly rolled tobacco like coming out, actually.
Mm. But because it's unfiltered, I'm just getting that more intently.
Yeah, and I think that is the thing. There's more character when you're making wines like that.
Yeah, which is why I think it's better that we tasted it second. Because this is, I don't want to say more pure, because obviously this is more pure.
Mm.
It's kind of a contradiction of itself, isn't it? But this is more stripped down, if that makes sense. And then this is more raw. That's how I would describe it.
Mm, I'd say this is more intense, and this is like maybe just a little bit more discreet.
Isn't that what I said?
Yeah. Just like just for anyone else, just giving them options of the language that we can all use.
Yeah, there's always different vernacular. Yes. Lots of vernacular, especially with us, Emily.
Yes, I know. But yeah, that was kind of like, we tried 3 appellations. Obviously, there are more.
12. Yes. There's 12 appellations.
12 appellations.
I was listening.
Look at you. You're very happy with that. but yeah, there are other, I think we'll just name the other crew before we sign off. So Bruy, which is obviously lower than the Cote de Bruy that we tried before. Chenasse, which is the smallest appellation in Beaujolais. Julienas, Chiroub, Moulin-Avant, Renier and Saint-Amour are the other crews. So if anybody sees them out and about, you should definitely check them out. And I think some of the lesser known ones are coming up. Like Renier, for example, is quite interesting. But Julienas is one of my favourite appellations, actually, and I think there's a lot of potential there. But if anybody has any questions about particular producers, crew, production techniques,
I have a question for you.
Other than Ollie,
nothing to do with winemaking. No, but I think this is interesting for the people who are listening, because one of the things as an amateur wine person, if you want to go learn about wine, the best way to do it is go to explore a region. Like, actually go and see what it's all about. I'm supposed to go to Gigondas, actually.
Gigondas.
Thank you. Exactly. Before Corona. And obviously that didn't happen. But the point is, going there makes you more familiar. You see the terroir. You see the environment. So what I would suggest for someone who's listening, one of your listeners, what's the best way to visit Beaujolais?
What's the best way?
Like, you go to Lyon, obviously.
So you mean how to access the region, yes, like physically?
Yes, like, so I want to do a wine tour of Beaujolais. Tell me how to... I fly into Lyon.
Lyon, I mean, or you can fly into Paris, and you can also take a train directly to Lyon, which is a nice way to travel.
Done that.
Yeah. I mean, or you come from the south. I think if you're in Marseille or...
you come north.
In Montpellier, you can take a train north. But yeah, Lyon is the closest airport, if not Paris. That's how I travelled there. I flew into Paris and I took a train and then hired a car.
And where do you want to go? If I had 3 days, a long weekend, wine tourism.
I mean, it depends on the style of wine that you want to have. But many of the Beaujolais towns, like in Fleury, there's some great restaurants, for example.
Mm.
And a lot of the towns have good restaurants.
I imagine.
So it would be possible, if anyone's interested in that, there'll be links to Inter Beaujolais. And they have a website, actually, that is set up with where to stay, where to go, what to see. I recommend one of the highlights for me, if you visit Beaujolais, is going to the UNESCO Geopark, looking at Montbruy and learning about that.
Blue stones.
And the blue stones. But that's really cool. And actually, in some of the places, like, for example, in Bruy, there is like a wine shop where you can go and you can taste all of the wines of that appellation. And that exists in a few other parts, but particularly in Bruy, that does exist. So I highly recommend that. Like, it's amazing just to have like an overview, and obviously visit like local wine bars and restaurants and just drink the wines. But being in the landscape, obviously, and seeing the vines is different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that, do you have another question, Arlene?
No, that was my last question. Because I'm going to go.
Oh, you're going. Is that why we're wrapping it up?
Right, okay. Oh, no, I'm going to go to Beaujolais.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was like, I'm going to go to Beaujolais. Okay. I thought you meant you were, like, leaving right now.
No.
Okay, good. So.
Thanks for having me.
So funny.
I'm going to drink this one.
Which one is that? That's the Cote P.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, we usually cheers at the end, but that's okay. Gwen.
The end.
Where are you, Gwen? Joking. No, Arlene, thank you very much. For anybody that wants to stay in touch with Arlene, please find her on Instagram, and her Instagram is Arlene Stein, and you can also find her on Terroir Talk.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
I feel like you had something else to add. No?
No, I'm not going to say anything.
And you can check in with her. And then, yeah, any questions about Beaujolais or the cruise or the wines that we tried today, where to find them, they're available in the UK and also the German market. So I'll happily pass those on. And we'll post links to those and the information of the wines. Yeah, and I think that's it, really. I don't know what else to say. And I guess you'll see me, you'll see me and hear me in the next weeks about some winery visits in the Canary Islands. And then, yes, me and Gwen will be back together. I'm sure Arlene will make another appearance at some point as well, in case any of you miss her in the interim. But until then, thank you, Arlene.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers.